This interview was conducted on Thursday, February 14th, 2019, at 110 and Lovejoy Library on SIUE's campus. And my name is Michael Limmer, and I am interviewing Joanne Condalone. Joan, could you please give us your name and your birth date?
I'm Joanne Condalone, and my birth date is October 14th, 1941.
Perfect. So if we could just talk a little bit about, you know, you grew up in Collinsville?
I did. I grew up in Collinsville. Was born there just before Pearl Harbor, for some context, yes.
So could you tell me a little bit? I know you grew up in an immigrant, with an immigrant family.
I did, and at that time, in those years, the early 40s, Collinsville was still primarily, at least in the immigrant community, was a coal mining town. The mines were beginning to close in some areas, but the last of the mines ran until the early 60s. But at that time, when I was born, there were still lots of union coal mines in southern Illinois and around us, and coal mining is what brought my great-grandfather, my father's mother's father, and my grandfathers from Italy to the United States and to Collinsville in particular, to make a living digging coal.
Mm-hmm. What was your great-grandfather's name?
His name was Giovanni Beruti. He's buried in the Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois. He died of black lung at the age of 43 in 1901, which in those days was young to die of black lung. Today, not so much because of the way that mining is done. But probably he died so young because of the kind of mining he did in Italy. He worked in a tungsten mine and some other mines that had high silica content, and it's the silica that's so deadly. So that's probably what killed him and left his widow with children to feed and not much money. So the man worked himself to death.
And that was your mother's father?
That's my father's mother's father. So it's my great-grandfather.
So what about your parents?
My mother was born in a beautiful little hill town in Tuscany called Massa Marittima that her people lived in for many, many generations. And my grandfather, her father, Annibale Borgassi, came to America with one of his brothers in 1913 to dig coal. Again, there was not enough work for people to feed their families in Italy, not working people. The land reform hadn't happened yet. There was no hope of ever owning your own property or moving anywhere socially or economically. So he came to America. He mined in the mines in Tuscany. Tuscany is full of mines. It's called the metal filled hills around them, not coal, but hard metals. So he came as an experienced miner. He came to southern Illinois where he knew people, where they told him, come here, there's work here. They also would have spoken the same Italian that he spoke, so it made it easier for him to integrate into a community. Because even though Italy was already a modern federation, at that time, this was pre-First World War, when he came, they were just struggling to have Tuscan as written spoken Italian. So it was not unusual for people to have such different dialects that they might have a hard time talking to each other. So if you came with people from your town, your province, your region, you were more likely to be able to actually understand each other. So he came to southern Illinois, worked for 2 years, sent for my grandmother and their three children to come to America. My grandmother didn't want to come to America. Typical of a woman of her time, she never really had the opportunity in her life to make any decisions for herself. Had it been up to her, she would have stayed in Italy. And when I met them and their town, I could see why. It's magnificent. But so they waited and waited and waited to go. The First World War was brewing. And my grandfather was sending anxious letters, please come, please come. So finally they came to America. Of course, none of them spoke any English. The oldest child, my Aunt Margaret, who had a magnificent memory and was absolutely fearless, sort of took charge of things. And when I was very young, and we sat around the table, and the stories were always told around the table after the meal with wine, she told me about that trip and about the ship having to turn the lights off because there were hostile ships in the area, and that it was a pretty scary time. So they made their way to America, and then all the way across from Ellis Island to Donkville, which is now part of Collinsville, to the coal mining town. And my aunt told me that when my grandmother woke up in the morning and saw this gray, ugly coal mining town where her house was, that she wept because it was not Italy. So they traveled around. They weren't from mine to mine. They eventually stayed in Collinsville, managed to build their own house. My two aunts married young, as was the custom. My Aunt Margaret married at 14, and her middle sister at 16. So my mother was at home with her parents. Mining was an iffy proposition. They worked, they didn't work. They struggled to make a union. There were some very hard times. So my mother went to work at 13 in a dress factory, and for many years was the primary breadwinner in her family when my grandfather wasn't working in the coal fields. My mother was extraordinary in that she didn't marry until she was 21. And she married on a Saturday, and she told me she got paid on a Friday. And the Friday night before she married, she gave her parents her last paycheck so that they would have that money from her. And then she and my father lived in a small rental house next door. Italian was the first language in that family. My mother was fluently bilingual, as were my aunts, although my Aunt Laura was not proud of being Italian and always refused to speak Italian. My Aunt Margaret spoke beautiful Tuscan, as did my mother. And so all of our events and family get-togethers were dual language. We sat around the table. There were three conversations. There was Italian-Italian, Italian-English, and English-English, and you sort of jumped in where you could. And there was always the focus on the story. So I grew up hearing about Massa Marittima, life in Italy, coming to America, how hard it was to work in the mines. Was my father's family. His father came from near Turin, a beautiful town called Pianezza, that still, my family there still owns my great-grandfather's house. I get to go visit it whenever I go to Italy. He bought it in 1861, and his picture is still in the parlor there.
Wow, that's
looking very dapper, leaning on his cane, and his bowler hat on his head, and the deed to his property is on the wall next to it. So it's now owned by one of my cousins, the grandson of one of my grandfather's brothers. So my grandfather was the only one to come to America. He spoke Piemontese, which is its own language, and some of the Northern Italian dialect. But spoke English always to me, unlike my other grandfather who always spoke Italian. And my father's father was a very charismatic, extremely bright man who was a cooper, that is, he made barrels, and a carpenter and a gunsmith. And he did a lot of organizing in the coal fields for John L. Lewis. And when the Great Schism came in the United Miners, union, and the offshoot union was formed. It was a kind of civil war, the Progressive Miners, which started in Gillespie. My grandfather was part of that group. I found a wonderful CCC trunk in the attic of my grandfather's house that has every scrap of paper that's the history of the Condalones in America in there, and there I found my grandfather's Progressives union card. There was a big civil war, people died, it came to a bad end. The United Mine Workers continued to be the representative miners union, but my grandfather went on to do other things. He took people hunting, he tried to open a bar, he opened a gunsmithing business. He wanted just to be his own boss. He's fiercely independent, a legendary shot, I hate to admit, a poacher. An absolutely interesting man. So that whenever we had family get-togethers, and we did often, my grandmother's sisters would come from other parts of Illinois and their husbands and children, and sometimes grandchildren, and we would have a great party on the lawn, and my grandfather would play his concertina. They would make smudge pots of tobacco to keep the mosquitoes away, and eventually the women would go upstairs and talk, and the men would go downstairs in the basement and pass the wine around and tell the stories, and I always went to the basement and sat and listened to the stories. I always loved the story from the time I was a very small kid. So I grew up hearing about life in America, about coal mining wars, about who was brave, who did stupid things. It didn't tell me everything, and there are still questions that I would ask if I could have one of them here. I would ask my grandfather about certain battles, if he was in them, and if he was at the Prager lynching, I would like to know that. I know he went to East St. Louis when it was burning in 1917 to see, because I could see the smoke, to see. My father said he just put his long gun over his shoulder and walked there from Collinsville and came back and said, it was pretty awful. There were people hanging from the street lamps and the city was burning. So he was that kind of a guy. He didn't take part in that battle. He was not a bigot. He was a communist and an atheist. And gave up communism for sort of democratic socialism late in his life, but never gave up his atheism, and believed truly and deeply in solidarity, as did they all. I never realized when I was a kid about how truly difficult their lives had been. I mean, imagine my mother never had a grandparent. Didn't have an aunt or an uncle. You know, there was no family. She told me about a woman in the coal mining town who had no grandchildren, and she was Czech, this woman, and they did not speak a common language, but they got very attached, and my mother would always accompany her when she went shopping and take her to buy her groceries and the things she needed for her house, and she would always buy my mother a little treat, and they would go to the old lady's house and they would have tea. And so she was sort of a surrogate grandmother for my mom, and my mother was sort of her surrogate grandchild. So you get the picture of people who have tremendous resilience and courage. So when I first started going to Italy 20-some years ago, and I found in Massa Marittima the full copy of my mother's birth certificate, and it had the address where she was born. So I went there, and I sat on a bench for 2 hours, just looking at it. And every year I go back, and my son was there this year, and I said, oh, please go by number 16 via Giuseppe Verdi and see who's there. And 1 year I was there, and there was a man working in a garage there, and I told him the story about my grandparents leaving there from there to go to Italy, and my mother being born there. And he took me home and made me coffee and fed me cookies and told me that a soldier had died there, an American, when the town was liberated in the Second World War by the Americans. So I have the great privilege of knowing family in Italy and America, and so we share the stories when I go, and they tell me about what it was like to live through the war, be occupied. One of my cousins there was a partisan, and he was an anti-fascist guerrilla fighter, and he would never talk about it, but the son of his best friend, who was also a partisan, would tell me the stories about how brave they were and what it was like to have your town not only occupied by the Nazis, but to have people that you grew up with that were fascists, and how divided the community was and how they struggled to be one community again after the war. And again, I saw that same kind of resilience. I remember walking down the street in Massa with the main street Via Libertà with my cousin Guido Mario, and he was in his late 70s, and it was August and the street was full of German tourists, and there was more German being spoken around us than English. And I said, Guido, doesn't this bother you? I mean, think of the days when you ran down the street to save your life with people who spoke this language shooting at you. And he shrugged, and he said, that was a long time ago. The war is over. It's a different world now. So I just was always astounded at their ability to live fully and not descend into regret and anger and to, again, I think it's a tremendous kind of resilience. It's the thing that, now that I'm elderly myself, other than the wonderful stories, because we all live by stories and we all try to figure out who we are and what the world is like through stories, but this gift of resilience, I think, is the greatest gift that I got from them. My father in particular, who was, everybody was born at home in the first two decades, you know, and he was born at home. For some reason, he had a physician and not the Italian midwife, Mrs. Marco, who delivered everybody else. I don't know why. Maybe there was something with my grandmother's pregnancy. But nonetheless, there was a young doctor, and he attended the birth. And my father was born with a very severe orthopedic deformity that's commonly called clubfoot. He would never have been able to stand. He certainly would not have been able to do manual labor to make a living. So this doctor set up. I have a classmate from Washington University who's in the orthopedic clinic. I'm going to send you to him. And I have the clinic card from my father's appointment in 1909 to go to the clinic, and they did corrective surgery on him. He was in the hospital for 4 months, and my grandmother went and stayed in a boarding house so that she could breastfeed him. And he wore really heavy braces up above his knees to his thighs for the first 9 years of his life. And I often wonder if that experience made him, or at least contributed to, the kind of patient, tough intelligence that he had. I mean, he had all of his life, and my son has it too. I wish I had it. I don't. This ability to simply look very clear-eyed, with very clear eyes, at a problem and say, ah, this is the problem. This is what we can do. Even if it was something really ugly or difficult, I never saw him descend into kind of pettiness or regret. He was an elected official for many years. He started out as a shop steward and ended up as president of his union for 20-some years, and integrated the officer corps of his union, and for that got shot at and beaten up and threatened. I can still remember answering the phone at 10 o'clock at night and someone saying to me, "Your father's not home, you don't know where he is, but I know where he is, and you're never going to see him again." So he was a genuinely tough guy, but he didn't, it didn't make him petty or mean or hateful or stupid. And I've always been sort of dumbfounded by that. I had the great pleasure to work with a physician who had that same temperament, who is a brilliant physician that I worked with for a long time. But I think seeing that kind of intelligence and that kind of temperament in action in difficult times is a remarkable thing. And I often, again, wonder if it was that experience of having to draw back, be a solitary person, to be moving around in these huge braces that gave him some perspective at a young age that he might not have acquired otherwise. Who knows? But he was quite a guy.
So it sounds like your family had a huge influence on you. You were very close, intertwined. How did you feel growing up in this immigrant home? It sounds like you adored it in some way. Like
in some ways, but you know, Collinsville was a very small town,
mm-hmm.
and it was rather static even then. And you know, I was a bright kid, and I lived in books, and I grew up with the stories, and I wanted to know what else there was in the world. I wanted to know everything there was in the world. I wanted out.
Mm-hmm.
The year I graduated from high school, the plant where my father worked moved out of East St. Louis, actually 10,000 union packing house jobs moved out of East St. Louis in those few years. It had been the biggest packing house center in the state outside of Chicago. Those jobs were gone, and East St. Louis obviously never recovered. And they went to my dad's plant, Armour's. I still don't buy Armour's products. Went to Alabama, a right-to-work state. So my dad was out of work for a year. There was no money. My parents were very frugal. They had no debts. We owned our house. My mother made our clothes. We gardened. My dad hunted. We didn't spend a lot of money. We always had a 10-year-old car. But by the end of that year, there was very little money left. My mother went, I remember, to work waiting on tables, and my father was horrified that he couldn't provide for his family. So I couldn't go to college. There was no question. I wasn't going to school. And I went to see a friend. And they said, a friend's mother said, oh, that her daughter was working for the telephone company, I should come and see. And I went with my mother to visit in this horrible place where all these women were sitting there, lined up at these nasty little machines. And that convinced me I was getting out of there one way or another. And that's why I went into the Army, because it seemed like a way to go to school. I mean, that's how they marketed it to you. It was a way to go to school. So I loved them, and I couldn't wait to get away from them. I wanted to know what was over the next hill, and I wanted the world of books, yes.
Before you got over that hill, and you know, for the world of books, take me through, like, what was the day like as being a kid in this family? What did your parents do, anything in particular?
Yeah, well, my dad took the bus to the packing house, so my mother got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and this was a four-room house, so people are up cooking and making coffee at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, going to hear that some mornings. So, while he was eating breakfast, she would make his lunch, and then he would go and get on the bus and go to work, and she would get my brother, I have a younger brother who's 3.5 years younger, up to go to school. she would make our breakfast and our lunch. We did not have money to buy lunches at school, and we had 2 cents for milk and sometimes an extra penny for a small piece of chocolate, because the principal at my school always had a little candy stand at lunch, and you could buy penny pieces of candy. We had a coal furnace, so my mother in the winter would have to go downstairs and make the fire. And I remember we had this Indian blanket, and my brother and I would huddle up with our bottoms up against the heat grate and wrap up in our Indian blanket until it warmed up in the kitchen, and then go to school. And all but the worst of weather, I walked the mile to school and back home again. My father typically didn't come home until late in the evening. My mother would save dinner for him. We never ate in a restaurant. My mother cooked all of our food from scratch. She canned and preserved, and as I said, my father hunted. We ate squirrel, we ate rabbit. We ate a lot of traditional Northern Italian and Central Italian foods. My mother made her own pasta. My father and mother pickled peppers and canned mushrooms. And it wasn't until I got into the wider world I realized that I ate like a king when I was a kid. You know, all the wonderful things that you have to go to a really good Italian restaurant to get today was standard fare. So there was that. So I didn't see a lot of my dad during the week because often he came home late, and because he was in the union hall after work. And sometimes the union, he was had a reputation as being an excellent mediator, so the union often sent him to other places, and he also did some teaching on how you organize a union. And sometimes he sent my mother with the women's group. She went to Washington and New York to represent the families of men who worked in the union. So they were deeply involved in it. Sometimes he would bring home, he would call and say he was bringing home two or three guys from either the state or the national union, and my mother would cook for them. She would make pasta, she would make chicken, she would make salads, and then I always got to sit at the table and listen to the conversations they were talking about with them. And what they were trying to do is preserve their union, negotiate for contracts. We always went to the union hall on the weekends, so I would go with my dad to the union hall. I have his desk that was in his office. It's enormous. And sometimes on Saturday afternoon, after we got out of the union hall, we would go to the Polish hall, and he would drink Boilermakers, and I would drink chocolate soda, and eat Mr. Peanut out of the package. And I loved going to union meetings with him. He took me once to an international meeting in Chicago. And I mean, he always treated me like an intelligent human being. He would say, now, here's what the problem is, and here's what we want, and here's what they want. Now, this guy is going to get up, and he's going to make this argument. And then you see that guy over there, he's really with this guy, and he's going to get up next, and he's going to support this argument by saying so. So what we have to do, and he would just tell me about how the mechanics of it, the strategy of it, how to look for who was, what they really wanted, what the arguments were. And then, you know, we would talk about it. Sundays, we always had a big dinner. We went to early Mass. We went to Bruno's Bakery after Mass and got goodies and brought them home. My mother made dinner from scratch. We listened to the Italian Hour on the radio, and we talked books, we talked politics, we talked about what was happening in the world. Sometimes we talked about Italy, but they were always really interesting conversations that included everybody. My grandparents, who lived down at the bottom of our road, would come up after lunch sometime in the middle of the afternoon, and there'd be coffee and cookies and wine. So there was a lot of family in the day-to-day. My step-cousin lived two doors away, and he's still one of my best friends. He's, let's see, I'm 77, he's 78, and we still hang out. And so there were kids in the neighborhood. We had a woods behind. In good weather, we spent the day. We would leave with a wagon and food, and we would go in the woods and build a fire and make a camp and get in the creek and hunt for crawdads. And nobody bothered us. You know, we'd go in the morning, we'd come home in the evening. In the winter, we'd take a sled. I remember we had a neighbor had a dash hound, and we would put him in a box on the sled and take him to the woods. So it was fairly uncomplicated. And I really had no concept of being part of an Italian minority, that Italians were a minority. And I wasn't aware of the horrific Italian stereotypes until I got older, until I certainly was in college, and then later in the university, and certainly when I lived in New York, and I realized how much anti-Italian sentiment there was, and how much the stereotypical Italian had so little to do with the life I knew as an Italian American, or with the Italians that I knew. The food was different, the relationship with the church was different, the patois was different. And so I began to understand my mother's kind of classic Tuscan snobbery, "We're not like them," as a defense of not being that stereotypical Italian. My first year in college, I was at SIU Alton. It was before this, the Edwardsville campus was open. This was like 61, 62, because I'd come back from the military. And I was taking a history survey course, and the very first meeting of the class, the professor said, "Oh, she'd just come back from a European trip," and that, and so she told us this little joke, and she said, "Well, she'd taken the train from Switzerland to Italy, and she knew when she passed over the border from Switzerland to Italy, because she looked at her watch, and her watch had been stolen." So I just remember that it just enraged me, and I was rising up out of my seat, and my friend who was sitting behind me put his hands on my shoulders and said, "Just sit down and shut up. You need to take this course." But I then began to understand again as I got into a wider world, but that certainly was not part of my consciousness as a young person. And now, of course, in the last 30 years, I've read an enormous amount about immigration and women immigrants and the great diaspora and the difference in culture from one province to another in Italy, but I was ignorant of it then.
So it sounds like as a kid you were very well rounded. You experienced a lot. Your parents exposed you to a lot, though, sounds like. So I know you ended up joining WAC, the Women's Army Corps.
Right out of high school.
Right out of high school?
Yes.
So 18?
Yes.
Okay.
18.
And you said you did that because that was the opportunity to go to college.
I was desperate to go to school. And it seemed to me that it would get me out of Collinsville. Mm-hmm. And it would help me get to school. Not necessarily by an easy route, but that it would get me there. And I was a pretty naive kid. I mean, I had never eaten in a fancy restaurant or ridden in a new car, so I passed all the tests. I did extremely well on their intelligence tests, so I got to choose my military occupational specialty, and I became a cryptographer. And when I went to cryptography school, it was a program that mostly men, of course. I mean, there weren't very many members of the Women's Army Corps. We're not integrated, of course, into the wider army. So the school I went to in Georgia, a god awful place, Fort Gordon, Georgia, just an awful place. In my class, there were 36 men and 4 women, and we were all, you know, we were all smart kids who from working class families who wanted to go to school and didn't have any money. I mean, we had that in common. One was from Boston, one was from Nebraska. Oh, God, I don't even remember who the fourth one was, but there we were. So, and then I got stationed at Fort Meade, Maryland. At that time, it was a huge post. 2.5 times bigger than my hometown. And, you know, it was before the world of computers. Things were automated, but they were not fully computerized. So I worked in this huge, busy communication center, you know, underground, locked in, badges and guns. And we worked shift work. So they made it absolutely impossible for me to go to school. And I complained a lot and went to visit people and made my complaints known, which was absolutely useless. They wanted me to, I took the officer candidate test, and I proficiencied out of, I don't know, how many hours of college, and they said, well, if you, you know, re-enlist, we'll send you to officer school, and then you'll be able to go to college for sure. But by that time, I didn't trust them anymore. And I had an experience. I'd already learned how dangerous it was to be a woman in the military. I learned that at Fort Gordon. I saw the way women who had problems were treated by our own cadre, who were, to a woman, all World War II veterans, and they really had contempt for us. I mean, they saw us as some sort of, who in the hell were we to wear their uniform? They were all veterans. They'd been in a war. So there wasn't much advocacy in our cadre. I'll give you an example. One day at work, I slipped. We worked in this incredibly noisy, busy unit, and these wires went back and forth across the walkway, and the intercom was blasting, and nobody was hearing it, so I went running down to pick up the intercom, because you had to respond, and I slipped, or tripped, with the wires, and I hit my head, just slam right on the top of my head, on the corner of a concrete post, and got nauseated and literally saw stars, sat down on the floor, felt really sick. So my commanding officer said, Condolin, you're going back to your company because I want you seen at the infirmary. So I got to the, I got back to my company, and my first sergeant sent me to the gynecologist because I was nauseated and dizzy, so I might be pregnant. So there I am in my uniform, no ring on my finger, sitting there with all these military wives, and I get to be examined for the first time in my life by an Army doctor who wants to know not what my neurological status is, but if I'm pregnant or not. So that's sort of a view of what it was like to be. I must have had a concussion, at least a light concussion. I mean, unfortunately, I woke up the next day, right? Mm-hmm. But they were ridiculous. You know, they were ridiculous. So later on that year, I was assaulted by a man who had a lot of rank, and I knew there was no percentage in making a complaint about that. But I also knew that I was out of there. I did not ever tell my parents because I didn't even tell another human being until late into middle age because I didn't think my parents needed to know that. They were horrified that they couldn't send their smart kid to college. It's the last thing I needed to tell them. So I told them it was because I couldn't go to school and the military refused to pay any attention to me. So I got a general discharge. If they tried to give me a dishonorable discharge, I would have fought that, but a general discharge seemed to be an easy way out, so I got out. And when I read about, you know, I read some of the things that Colonel Ann Wright has written about women in the military, and I see how women are treated 56 years later, it still makes me really, really angry. So, I don't think I had PTSD, but what I had, and it took me much of my 20s to figure out where in the hell I was going from school to school and job to job, to sort of reroute myself in the world, is that I developed a great contempt for bureaucracies in organizations, and I saw them all as incompetent and stupid. So it took me probably longer to mature into adulthood. And then, of course, I chose a profession, midwifery, which is a constant negotiation with the powers that be and with the bureaucracy, is to advocate for patients. So I must have figured it out for a while, but it did. I don't know that even at this age I fully comprehend what all of that meant to me for sorting out my life in my 20s. Yeah.
So how long were you part of the Women's Army Corps?
2 years.
Only 2 years?
Yes.
And then, so you leave. You
know. I went back to, came home and went to SIU Alton, and then I went to University of Arizona, moved to New York, and, you know, went to NYU for a while, went to Hunter College for a while, worked in printing and publishing, which I loved, I absolutely loved. Started doing volunteer work on the Lower East Side where I lived. I was really involved in the anti-war movement and the integration movement. I had a lot of friends on the Lower East Side who were activists, and the group that I volunteered for, which was just a storefront social service, you know, that helped people get enough to eat and go to the doctor and find a place to live, and I helped with their children's program. Which I loved, I absolutely loved. And so out of that, I met a lot of community activists. And in 68, when there was War on Poverty Money, a local organization got a huge grant to start a community development project. They were called the Real Great Society. They were a coalition of Puerto Rican and Black, and later, additionally, Chinese former gangs. And we had a grant that came from them to run a program called the University of the Streets. And the man who was the exec of that was a man I knew from other community work, and he asked me to come to work for them and run their children's program. So I did that for the last few years that I was in New York.
So you went from SIU Alton,
mm-hmm.
and then from there you went to Arizona?
Mm-hmm. I went to University of Arizona.
How long were you out there?
Just a semester, because I couldn't afford it, and I absolutely loved it. And I had good friends from the military there who really wanted me to come and put my life together there. I loved it. Great school. I had the world's best Italian instructor, and a really fine writing teacher. I simply couldn't afford it. And I had friends in New York, and in those days it was easy to find work, it was easy to find a cheap apartment. I was determined that I would only be there shortly, and then I was going to Italy, but it took me some time to get to Italy. But so I went to New York.
So you went to New York. The pull was friends and a job.
And yes. Being able to go to school very inexpensively, yeah.
So then you also mentioned while you're out there you did a lot of different types of, like, activist work, different organization. How long did you do that? How long were you in New York? What?
I was in New York almost 10 years. Yeah. My partner and I had Sam, my only child, in 70. And University of the Streets was pretty much in shambles at that time. And I had gone back to work for the loft offset lithography company that I had worked for some time. And I was a very strong union shop, and I met a lot of really old-fashioned, smart activists there who were very much involved in the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt at home with those guys. They were, for the most part, men. And then we had Sam, and I had this sort of epiphany when I had Sam. I had a wonderful pregnancy. I studied Lamaze with Elizabeth Bing, the woman who brought Lamaze to America. I had a wonderful labor and birth. Couldn't have been more normal, unmedicated. I came out of it feeling like an adult. And then 4 weeks postpartum, was dreadfully sick with septicemia, 105.6 temperature, back in the hospital, nearly died, got better. And while I was getting better, figured out that I was going back to school, I was going to be a midwife, and I was going home to do it because I knew that George and I would need help with the baby and the world, and so that's what I did.
So you met George in New York?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you mentioned also that you were one, you were of the minority women, it was from majority men. What was that like, being the only woman? Was it?
Well, you know, I grew up, you know, I grew up in the Union Hall and with all these uncles.
Mm-hmm.
I like men. I've always liked men. And I think because I grew up with such interesting men. And I felt comfortable. I had no... Did I get hit on? Yes. Did I respond? For the most part, not. Did I have wonderful mentors who were men as well as women? Yes. So I would say the worst experiences I ever had being a female minority was in the military, but the military condoned and promoted violence against women. And that was not true of the people I worked with in the community development organization. And that was not true of the old-fashioned socialist activists that I worked with in the printing business. So I was good there, yeah.
Okay, so then also New York, you did printing.
I first worked for a publisher. I worked for G.P. Putnam Sons. And then I realized that I just loved that production piece of it, putting things together. So I went and got this job in... at this offset lithographers, and I actually was the first woman they ever hired in production, and I just loved it. I loved all the problem solving. I loved going to the other presses. I you know, took classes. It was just really, really, plus, as I said, a lot of the, certainly not management, but the craftspeople were old-time union guys, and I understood that, you know. I felt at home there. Of course, later I realized I was the only production person who didn't have fund profit sharing,
mm-hmm.
right? But it took me a while to figure that out. So, yeah, I worked for them right up until my maternity leave. They were very kind to me, you know. They'd say, come in when you can, stay as long as you can. Sometimes they sent me home in a cab. And then after I had Sam, I trained a couple of replacements. One didn't work, the next one didn't work, the next one didn't work. And they said, come back, you will pay your daycare. And I knew if I did that, I'd be doing that the rest of my life, and that I really needed to go back to school and find my own profession.
So what year was Sam born?
70.
1970. Okay.
Thank you.
So you move back to Collinsville with George and Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And you come back. What's the plan? You get your
the plan is to get a degree in nursing, work for a couple of years, go to graduate school, get a master's degree in nurse midwifery, and go live in Canada. That was the plan.
What was the draw in Canada?
It wasn't America. It stayed generally out of the war. We had friends who'd moved there. It was cheap to homestead. We'd bought 100 acres on Cape Breton Island, which we still own. Only Sam and I own it now instead of George and I own it. And so we would homestead, and I would go be a nurse in Canada. And that was our goal. It was to raise our child in a safe place. Vietnam was hell on my brother and so many of our generation, and I figured by the time my son was 18 there would be another war, and it was about keeping my child safe and living close to the sea,
mm-hmm.
which is something I love. So we came back here. I indeed did get my bachelor's degree in short order.
From
here,
SIUE.
Mm-hmm. And went to work at a wonderful little hospital that doesn't exist anymore in East St. Louis, Christian Welfare. And then I got, at that time, St. Louis University had a master's degree in midwifery. Part of the war on poverty, which is probably not as well known as some of the other issues, was a great initiative for expanded practice nursing, advanced practice nursing. Midwives have always been advanced practice nurses. We always did more and had more responsibility than most nurses. So there was all this money to send people like me off to get advanced practice skills so that we could fill that niche between doctors and less skilled practitioners. So St. Louis University had a master's in midwifery at that time, and I got accepted into that program, and I had a federal fellowship that paid for my entire graduate education. Gave me a stipend, which paid my daycare. So I got an excellent master's degree. And because I had no debt, and I had $700 in debt from undergraduate school, I had a certain freedom to go take care of poor women, which is what I wanted to do. So here it was impossible to deliver babies. I taught nursing. I went to Texas on the Rio Grande border with a Catholic institution and did an internship for a summer. Came back and got a job in the then forming only full practice midwifery service in the region, which was at St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. And the physicians threatened to boycott the hospital if they didn't get the midwives out of there, so off we went. No midwifery practice. So for years I ran a family planning STD clinic. I worked for the State Department of Public Health evaluating family planning services. I was the administrator of a perinatal project in Centerville where we took care of pregnant women and then did some family planning, and then realized I'm 50 and when am I going to practice fully? My then husband, George and I had long parted when Sam was 4, and I remarried in 78, and my husband was a professor here. He was getting ready to retire, and we kept our house here. We bought an old farmhouse in Pennsylvania, and I went out there and practiced. He died just several years after we moved there, and I continued to practice there until 2008 when I retired and came back here. So I did deliver my babies.
So why did you never go to Canada? Let's say if that was the goal.
George and I separated, and there I was trying to find my way in practice with this young child.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed more important than ever for him to be close to my parents. He and my father were very close. He knows stories my father never told me. He was, Sam was really attached to my family. Then later when I remarried, you know, Bill was
mm-hmm.
a tenured professor. We were not going to Canada. And the years passed.
Mm-hmm.
I go to Canada often. Sam and I went for the first time together last year, and we walked our property together. No easy feat. It's wooded and wild. And I would still love to live on Cape Breton Island, but not in the woods. I love it there. I love the proximity to the sea. I like the island mentality of people. They're very private, but cooperative at the same time. There's lots of art. I love the place. So I go when I can.
It's fascinating. So I want to backtrack, and
mm-hmm.
I want to hit a few things. So you mentioned your brother
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Was your brother deployed?
My brother enlisted when
okay.
he was still in high school. There were 8 of them that enlisted together in the Marines. My
mm-hmm.
brother was a Marine. My brother was, still is, a very handsome, articulate man. No interest in higher education. Quite an athlete, football, track, and field. So went off to the Marine Corps. He called me from San Diego when he was, because they took a ship. They were leaving, and I begged him not to go. Said, "You don't have to go to war. You know, you don't have to go to war. If you want to go to Canada, I'll go to Canada with you. If you want to go," I mean, I was a young single person, and he hung up on me. And, you know, it took me years to realize how much I'd insulted him. We were raised to take care of people, to engage with our community and do what we could. I couldn't imagine how he could survive if he killed while he was there. And he damn near didn't. He had terrible PTSD. He's in his 70s now. He's he has a wife, a good marriage, a child, a grandchild. But 50 years of struggle to get there,
mm-hmm.
and I do not exaggerate.
So then also, what's going on? By the time you get back in 1970 to Collinsville, what's going on with your parents, and what are they doing?
Well, my dad was in his 60s. He was working for the city of Collinsville, and he was also a township trustee for Collinsville Township. He's always, you know, he was a precinct committeeman for years.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been involved. He'd always been involved in his community. I mean, I used to love to make rounds with him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, well, so-and-so lives there, and that one's going to need a ride to the polls, and this woman needs help with that, and we need to bring, there was a surplus food to this family. I mean, he knew everybody and everything. I mean, it was his way to just tend to people. He tended
mm-hmm.
to people. So he was still in politics. He had terrible arthritis. His health was not good. Terrible pain, really a horrific amount of pain. I went mushroom hunting with him. We had great times. He loved getting to know my son. They spent a lot of time together. Things were tense because my brother's PTSD. It was difficult to see my parents' age and my father's world mold become smaller and smaller as he aged. It was interesting when I went to Pennsylvania in 91. We had been here 20 years. Sam was an adult. We had spent a lot of time together. The Sunday meals, the celebrations, the making pasta together, the feeding my colleagues, the hunting mushrooms, the listening to the story. There was a, I had a party and said, you know, I'm going to Pennsylvania and Bill's going to split his time between here and there. And my mother was beside herself. My father said, you know what you need to do for your profession. We'll manage. When I went back there, he had knee replacement surgery, which I begged him not to have, because I felt he was a terrible surgical risk, and I didn't like his doctor. I liked the hospital even less. And he said, look, you know, I can't get around. I'm incapacitated with pain. This is a risk I have to take. And it killed him. He had a post-op heart attack, which they were all too stupid to notice until he was in congestive heart failure. And we got him into Barnes for excellent care, but he had too much cardiac damage, and he died. So I felt that if I had been here and seen him up close, that I might have figured it out. So that was really horrible. That was horrible. It was horrible for all of us. My mother, who, you know, she'd been married. She was 81. And he was the only man she'd ever dated or kissed. He proposed to her on their first date. She'd known him her whole life. I mean, it was really hard for her. Yeah. And my brother was great. He spent a lot of time with her, stayed with her a lot of the time. But, you know, I came and went from Pennsylvania. I mean, then my husband died, and there was all of that. So it was a really difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sounds very difficult. So you're living in Pennsylvania. Your husband dies. What brings you back?
We had bought a farmhouse, mm-hmm. and so I'd rehabbed it. I had a community I loved there. I was working at that time just part-time with a practice with a physician that who's from Pena, Illinois. That I was really fond of. We had a really good collaborative relationship, and I had hired a couple of other midwives that I liked. So all of that was good. But, you know, I lived in a very rural setting, in a 135-year-old house that I just managed to finally finish rehabbing. I was really involved with, I'd started a writer's group. I was involved with the Arts Council. I lived in a community of organic farmers. There were some really good writers among us. So there were a lot of really good things there, but I was tired of living in Appalachia, and I felt that I wanted to live at least in town and not quite so rural, so that it wasn't so very hard to get to things. 20 minutes to the grocery store, an hour and a quarter to the hospital, etc. So, and then Sam said he was getting married, so I thought, great, perfect time to come back home. And we had kept the house, that the little farm that Bill and I had bought here, and Sam was living in it, so that became his place, and I bought a house in town. So what was left of my family, one cousin that I'm particularly fond of, my now 94-year-old aunt, my brother and my son are here, so I came back here.
And did you pick up midwifery when you came back?
Well, my intention was to practice part-time, but the state of Illinois made that really impossible. They wouldn't recognize the, oh my God, all of those. They didn't have any reciprocal certification. That was going to be a very long, expensive process. It was impossible to work part-time and pay for my insurance because midwife carries a big cost for insurance, and of course the institution had already always provided my insurance in Pennsylvania. So in order for me to work and be able to afford insurance, I either had to work full-time and pay for my own insurance or work full-time for an institution that would pay for my insurance. And I didn't want to work full-time. I wanted to work part-time mm-hmm. and to write, because I'd started writing again about 30 years ago, and I knew that I couldn't practice all the time and write mm-hmm. too, and not get old on top of it. Mm-hmm. So it just became impossible. Mm-hmm. So I haven't practiced since I moved back here. In fact, I've retired mm-hmm. my certification and my nursing licensure. I volunteer for a hospice, but not as a nurse, as a civilian volunteer. So that's the nursing I do now.
So your son now, he's 38, 39?
He's going to be 49 this year.
Oh, 49.
Yes.
Decade.
He's practically middle-aged.
Yeah. So what's next? What's next for you? What are you doing now? What drives you now?
I think that the story, you know, the two things I've loved most consistently in my life are the story and midwifery. And those two things have a surprising amount in common in that they both require you pay exquisite attention to what's going on, and that you're not quite the center of the universe, the process or the thing is. And I really like that. I really like that kind of deep engagement. So when I came back here, and God, I've taken courses from some wonderful people on this campus, Jeff Smith and Valerie Vogren and Allison Funk, who've just been wonderful to me and had pieces that I like published and find myself writing. So there's that. And it's sort of, and I think that it has to do with the developmental stage of old age, of generativity. I think that my tribe is the tribe of immigrant women, of labor organizers. And so I work with a Mother Jones Museum, I work with an Italian organization that I co-founded here on the campus, and we tell the story. We tell the story of who did all this work, and who developed the middle class, and what immigrants mean, and how we got to be a modern democracy, which is in working for the museum and for the Italian Cultural Association in writing, are the only things that keep me from absolute despair about the state of my society and my culture and my democracy, which I see as grim, much grimmer than it was when we were marching on the Pentagon in 1967. I see things as grim, so I feel an urgency to be part of the group that says, hey, wait a minute, look at this. There's a lot to be learned from this, and isn't it interesting? So I think it's that. I think it's generativity. It's saying that this is the way to give back to all those people. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think about my great-grandmother, who died impoverished in a state institution, probably with a kind of dementia. When I got her death certificate, I was so excited I found out where she died, and I sent her a death certificate. It didn't have a goddamn stamp piece of useful information, and I realized she died among strangers who knew nothing about her. And that's so awful. So, and then I think about, you know, my grandmother, her daughter, going to work at 15 because she had to help feed people. And my mother going in the dress factory at 13. And, you know, I got to spend 6 years in a university. And I have this healthy old age, you know. And I'm always buying another book and reading another story and speaking to another class. Yesterday I got to talk to two classes of really smart young people at Roxana about why it's important to study immigrants. So you have to say thank you. I have to say thank you.
It's a great message. It really is.
I'm a very privileged human being. And I know who's, there's a great song. There's a song called The Price of Coal. And it comes out, a song that was written out of the Spring Hill mining disaster in Spring Hill, Nova Scotia in the 50s. And the line in the song is, the price of coal is paid in blood and bone. So I think it's important to remember that.
It is. I think that is a perfect place for us to end it. It's a great message. Thank you so much, Joanne.
What fun, Michael. What fun. You're so sweet to let me do this.
Thank you so much.
I hope I get to meet you again, Michael.
Oh, we will.
You get into that master's program, I want to meet that professor.
Will do. Thank you.